is VOA News via remote, and I'm Laurel Boomen. Uganda's Election Commission Saturday declared incumbent Yoweri Museveni the winner of the presidential election, extending his 35-year rule as his main rival alleged fraud and urged citizens to reject the result. Museveni won 5.85 million votes, or 58.64% of the total, while main opposition candidate Bobby Wine won 3.48 million votes, or 34.83% of that total. The results were announced by the Electoral Commission in a televised news conference. Suicide rates in Japan have jumped in the second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, particularly among women and children, even though they fell in the first wave when the government offered generous handouts to people. A survey found the July-October suicide rate rose 16% from the same period a year earlier, a stark reversal of the February-June decline of 14%, according to the study by researchers at Hong Kong University and Tokyo Metropolitan Institute of Gerontology. Saudi Arabia expects to reopen its embassy in Qatar in the coming days, Saudi's foreign minister said on Saturday, following a U.S.-backed detente last week in a three-year-old dispute between Arab states. It's just a matter of logistics, Saudi Arabia's foreign minister told journalists in Riyadh when asked about embassy reopenings. An aftershock jolted Indonesia's Sulawesi Island on Saturday as rescue workers combed the rubble of collapsed buildings for survivors after an earthquake killed at least 46 people on Friday and sent thousands of residents fleeing in panic. The country's disaster mitigation agency said no damage or casualties were reported from Saturday's magnitude 5.0 tremor in West Sulawesi, which shook the area a day after the magnitude 6.2 quake. This is VOA News. Two rebel-controlled regions in eastern Ukraine will hand over a group of detainees to Kiev, the Russian TASS news agency reported. The report did not detail how many people would be transferred to the capital, but said the group included women, elderly people, and people with serious medical conditions. It also said the move would be a unilateral action and was mediated by the Ukrainian opposition politician Viktor Medvedchuk. He's an ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Democratic President-elect Joe Biden on Saturday nominated U.S. foreign policy veteran Wendy Sherman, a key negotiator of the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran, to be the number two official at the State Department. Biden also nominated Victoria Nuland, who has worked for secretaries of state and presidents from both parties, to be undersecretary for political affairs, effectively the third-ranking U.S. diplomat. And President-elect Biden has unveiled a plan to speed up the U.S. COVID-19 vaccine rollout. The plan includes increased federal funding, the creation of thousands of vaccination centers, and use of the Defense Production Act to expand the production of vaccination supplies. The ambitious plan is part of Biden's effort to achieve his goal to get 100 million Americans vaccinated within 100 days. Biden called for states to widen the pool of people they are currently vaccinating. His plan also includes proposals to create federally funded community vaccination centers, as well as mobile clinics for underserved communities. And he underscored the need for Congress to approve more money to fund his proposals. The United States remains the worst hit country in the world by the coronavirus. More than 23.5 million cases have been reported in the U.S., with the world's number of cases at over 93.9 million. 2.1 million people have died of the virus globally, with the U.S. reporting more than 392,000 deaths. And Biden has named a new director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy. That person is pioneering geneticist Eric Lander. And Biden elevated this post to cabinet-level status for the first time. Lander is a Harvard and MIT professor who helped lead the Human Genome Project. He will also serve in the role of presidential science advisor. In a statement, Biden said, quote, "Science will always be at the forefront of my administration, and these world-renowned scientists will ensure everything we do is grounded in science, facts, and the truth." For more on these and other stories making headlines today, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Boomen, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
The Commission at some point came out and said journalists should not be allowed with their cameras around polling stations, but we wrote to the Electoral Commission seeking for a clarification as to how journalists would do their work if we're not allowed to move with their cameras around polling stations.
A Ugandan journalist group says media professionals have little room to operate in the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections.
Our elections have always been credible and are always credible. We do not see that there should be any allegations of rigging in advance whatsoever, because whatever allegations which have been there in the past, nobody has been able to prove them.
A Zambian group wants the authorities to prevent international poll observers from countries heavily hit by COVID from coming to monitor this year's elections.
Humanitarian assistance continues to be constrained by the lack of full, safe and unhindered access to Tigray, caused both by insecurity but also bureaucratic obstacles imposed by federal and regional authorities.
And UN agencies criticize Ethiopian authorities for blocking humanitarian aid from reaching civilians and refugees caught up in the fighting in the northern Tigray province. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Uganda Electoral Commission has declared incumbent President Yoweri Museveni winner of the presidential election with 58.64% of the total vote cast. Main challenger Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, presidential candidate from the National Unity Platform, or NUP, came in second with 34.83%. But Bobi Wine has rejected the result as rigged. Meanwhile, the parliamentary election results show a significant number of cabinet ministers lost their seats to candidates from the opposition, including the NUP. Godbert Tumushabe is a lawyer, policy analyst, social entrepreneur, and a prominent Ugandan civil rights activist. He tells me that the poll results show that Ugandans have lost confidence in President Yoweri Museveni's administration.
So the declaration is not surprising, because every election in Uganda is organized to make sure that Museveni is declared winner. Second, I think what is most instructive is the fact that the elections is like a vote of no confidence in Mr. Museveni's government, because almost the majority of his ministers lost elections in the parliamentary race, actually beaten mainly by the members of the National Unity Platform, entirely newcomers into the electoral race. So I see that really as a vote of no confidence in the president himself and his government.
But Godbert, do you think that the elections were free, fair, transparent and credible? Because opposition groups are crying foul that they were rigged.
No, first of all, the elections in Uganda can never be free and fair as long as President Museveni is the candidate, because the entire machinery of the state, the military, the police, the Electoral Commission, the intelligence services, they are all mobilized and organized to make sure that Museveni is declared the winner. Secondly, we have had 2 months of campaign which have been punctuated by cases of violence, candidates being disrupted from campaigning. The whole of central Uganda, where the leading opposition candidate, Bobi Wine or Robert Kyagulanyi, has his main base, the Electoral Commission banned the campaigns from there. So there was no campaigning. And thirdly, the transmission of the results. The government shut off the internet and social media platforms. The results were being transmitted through a secret system run only by the Electoral Commission. So really, there was a total lack of transparency on the transmission of the results. Therefore, you can never be sure of what was being transmitted to the Electoral Commission.
The head of the European Union poll observer mission in Uganda to monitor the elections there, Ambassador Attilio Pacifici, has said they are impressed with the level of organization and peaceful conduct exhibited during the presidential and parliamentary polls held on Thursday. What do you make of this assessment?
I think that assessment is really neither here nor there, because if you are an observer, you land into Kampala or you land into Uganda 5 days before the election, and you are only observing 8 hours of voting after 2 months of extreme violence, disruptions of activities by political players, I don't see where you base your assessment that this was a free and fair election. I think that these observers are actually some of the most misleading people when it comes to the credibility of elections in countries like Uganda, where elections are run as military operations.
Where does the opposition go from here? Because previously they've gone to court to challenge the outcome of the elections. They have not been successful. Dr. Chisa Besigye said that he will not participate in this year's elections because it will be rigged. Some are also saying that Bobi Wine has effectively taken the crown of Dr. Chisa Besigye with its tones. He appears to be the official leader of the opposition in Uganda.
The challenge that we have in Uganda is that our problems are not legal. We are dealing with a political problem which must be addressed politically, because the biggest disservice that President Museveni has done to Uganda is to destroy institutions of state or build them into patronage systems that even the judiciary. Remember, Peter, that having been in power for 35 years, President Museveni has appointed every judge from the lowest court to the highest court. So there is no way you can expect the judiciary to function with the level of independence where there are internal checks and balances, because everybody, whether it is the judges, whether it is the judicial administration, they have all been appointed by the same man. And therefore, the idea that if you are aggrieved with the elections and you go to challenge them in the same court, it's almost going to the court which is presided over by Museveni. So my view is that the political actors, the political players, and this really goes beyond the opposition, because the people who are affected are not people who are just engaged in active politics. They are everywhere. All the institutions of citizenship, like civil society, like professional associations, and many others have been affected by the dictatorship that keeps Museveni in power. So going forward, I think that Ugandans need to be engaging more in the political process to resolve the issues that are outstanding politically, because the judicial process is part of the failures of the current system.
Godbert Tumushabe is a lawyer, policy analyst, social entrepreneur, and a prominent Ugandan civil rights activist. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The executive director of the Human Rights Network for Uganda Journalists says media professionals had little room to operate in the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections. Robert Sempala says the shutdown of the internet undermines the integrity and credibility of the polls. His remarks come after main opposition challenger Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, also known as Bobi Wine, rejected the outcome of the election, citing voter irregularities and rigging. The Electoral Commission dismisses the accusation as false. Robert Sempala tells me that the shutdown of the internet and popular social media platforms, including Twitter and WhatsApp, led to the spread of false information about the results of the polls.
Well, our main concern as journalists in this country was the total shutdown of internet. So all social media platforms and mainstream media houses could not freely receive and disseminate information, because it was one of the key processes that we are going to use to receive and disseminate information, but also to use to trail and collect live coverage of candidates. Also, journalists were being blocked from accessing most of the news-making places, because they were not accredited to cover elections by the Media Council. Even for the local journalists, that is unprecedented. So many ended up depending on a few journalists who could keep hopping from one place to another. Others ended up defying the orders and deployed their journalists even when they were not accredited to cover elections. Because what we have always had in Uganda is journalists that are assigned by their respective media houses that have licenses to operate were not interfered with, as long as they were local journalists. But this time around, local journalists and foreign correspondents were heavily restricted from
traversing the place.
Do you think the shutdown of internet in Uganda would have any impact on the credibility of the elections?
The shutdown created a lot of misinformation. It created a lot of curtailment for exposure of things that were happening onto journalists, onto other Ugandans. We're not able to promptly disseminate information to the wider public, so there was denial of information, which is very key in an election. But also, candidates were not freely, could not freely share their plight. They could not access results from different areas, especially for monitors and observers who had deployed their personnel, and they were charged with sharing results for ease of reference in case there was controversy over results. That was not possible. And also the fact that information was only restricted to mainstream media, that is television and radio stations, it was a very big setback in a democracy, in a civic process like an election, which is supposed to encourage democracy. So the process generally cannot be talked of as free and fair, given the fact that one key tool of information sharing was completely down, that is the internet.
Some people are saying that the security agencies made it very difficult for journalists to cover this year's election in Uganda. However, supporters of the NRM, the government, are saying that the journalists have been siding with the opposition and have been writing or broadcasting, basically undermining and making the government and President Museveni unpopular. Misinformation is being sent through social media platforms against the government, and that is why the government had to act. How do you respond to that?
That is not a true assertion, because the shrinking space for the media started way back before elections, where the government just could not contend with a population that is fully informed about so many happenings, that holds leaders to account through constructive interrogation in the media. And as such, many media houses, including those that work for government, were operating under very severe restriction from government. But also, the fact that government propagates a narrative that media is biased, they are bent on dating the image of government, is not extremely true, because no journalists have been charged for such crimes of causing ill will against the government.
During the election process, did anything happen to any journalists for which your group took action to help the journalists out?
Yeah, we had some journalists arrested. One is unfortunately still in cells in western Uganda, in the part of Hoima. He was arrested for taking a photograph, yet he was accredited to cover elections. But the police in there insisted that the Electoral Commission did not allow journalists to carry their cameras and take photos. Yet that is a very wrong understanding of the directives given by the Electoral Commission. Because the Electoral Commission at some point came out and said journalists should not be allowed with their cameras around polling stations. But we wrote to the Electoral Commission seeking for a clarification as to how journalists would do their work if they were not allowed to move with their cameras around polling stations. And then there was a change of directive to say, okay, journalists can access the polling stations and take pictures, but as long as they do not take the people, the voters, while casting their votes. And of course, that has always been the order of the day. We do not take pictures of people voting.
Robert Sempala is the executive director of Human Rights Network for Uganda Journalists. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Zambia, a consortium of civil society and student organizations is calling on the Electoral Commission and the Foreign Ministry to prevent international poll observers from countries heavily impacted by COVID from coming to monitor this year's elections. Andrew Intewewe is the spokesperson for the umbrella group called Democracy and the Motherland Defenders Coalition, or DMDC. He says foreigners with the disease should be kept from coming into the country as part of an effort to limit the spread of the coronavirus. But critics say preventing foreign observers from monitoring the elections may enable corrupt individuals to rig the elections. They also accuse Interwewe and members of the group of working for the ruling party to undermine the integrity of the polls, an accusation he denies. Interwewe tells me that Zambia has a good track record of administering credible elections. He also argues that the upcoming polls will stand up to both local and international scrutiny.
Right now we are in the rain season and we'll soon be going in the cold season. And the cold season is what is very, very dangerous for COVID-19. Our call as a coalition is that the Electoral Commission of Zambia has to work with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to limit the number of international observers that are going to come for the general elections, which are slated in August. Our belief is that this call is going to help Zambia as we are trying to and grappling with fighting this COVID-19. But additionally, we think that our call goes in tandem with international standards, that it will be able to help the entire globe to reduce the number of COVID-19 cases around the globe.
But Andrew, some people are suggesting that if Zambians who will be voting will be observing the COVID-19 protocols as established by the Ministry of Health, similarly, the foreign poll observers could do the same thing, and that could limit the spread of the disease. So it appears your group is targeting foreign observers from coming to observe the elections. What do you say to that?
We are not targeting foreign observers, and there is no reason why our coalition would target foreign observers. In fact, we must be very clear that we want to understand Zambia's track record of having elections. And these elections have been very open to international observers. I can't remember of any time that an election in Zambia was held without so many international groups coming in this country. We have never had that problem as a country. No, we haven't had. You must be able to understand that we are dealing with a very peculiar case here. The COVID-19 has hit the entire globe. It has hit even the very most advanced countries in the world. And you want to be able to understand that countries like Zambia have tried by all means to try and limit the people that are getting this virus. But take note that our healthcare systems are not as developed as the ones that are in the United States, like the ones that are in Europe. Now, if Europe and the United States is having these very serious challenges where thousands of people have already died from COVID-19, how is our healthcare system going to cope? If, for instance, we just leave our doors, our borders open, that people come from COVID hotspots and come in this country, it will be deadly.
Andrew, some people also suggest that it appears you are doing the bidding of a political party to seek to prevent the international poll observers from coming in to observe what some people suggest could be an election that could be tilted or rigged in favor of one political party or the other, and that the presence of international poll observers sometimes limits the ability of a group of people or some people who want to rig the election. What do you say to that?
First of all, I come from the Young African Leaders Initiative primarily, and the Young African Leaders Initiative is a non-partisan organization. The coalition for which I am the spokesperson, the Democracy and Motherland Defenders Coalition, is a non-partisan coalition. The issue here at hand is a matter of health, and I think people have to be able to look at it in terms of how we are going to protect the global citizens from having this challenge. You want to be able to understand that even the call that we have brought about, we have brought this call very early on so that the Electoral Commission of Zambia must be able to engage with stakeholders, must be able to engage with the foreign affairs so that this matter can be handled in an amicable manner, in as smooth a way as much as possible. But most importantly, Zambia's track record of having elections is there for all to see. Zambia is a beacon of hope on the African continent. Zambia's elections have been free and fair, and this has been attested to by various international organizations that have come in this country. Zambia is one of the countries in Africa where we have had peaceful transitions of power from a party in government losing an election in 1991, UNIP lost that election. We had a peaceful transition of power. In 2011, we had the MMD, which was the party in government, losing an election to the PF. So our elections have always been credible and are always credible. We do not see that there should be any allegations of rigging in advance whatsoever, because whatever allegations which have been there in the past, nobody has been able to prove them.
Andrew Ntewewe is the spokesperson for the Zambian Umbrella Group Democracy and Motherland Defenders Coalition, or DMDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The African Continental Free Trade Area, or AFCFTA, came into effect on January 1, but no goods are being traded under the agreement yet. The deadline for countries to commit to the required 90% of tariff lines they will phase out over the next 5 years has been extended to July. The aim is to create the world's largest free trade area since the establishment of the World Trade Organization to attract investors and create jobs. For VOA, Vicky Stark spoke to the chairman of the AFCFTA negotiations taking place under the auspices of the African Union Commission, South Africa's Ambassador Xavier Karim.
54 of Africa's 55 countries have signed the agreement. 41 of these have made tariff reduction offers. Karim, who's also South Africa's Deputy Director General of Trade in the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, says the readiness of individual countries varies considerably across the continent. A virtual AU Heads of State Summit on December 5th decided to push ahead with the launch on New Year's Day because they couldn't wait for everyone to be at the same starting point.
What happened on the 1st of January? It is somewhat historic, but I think it needs to be properly understood. What took effect on the 1st of January is a legal framework that will allow AU members to, in an incremental way, enter into preferential trade relations between individual members, AU members, but also between the various customs unions that we have in Africa.
Karim elaborates.
The important customs unions in Africa that are negotiating as a bloc include SACU, at the Southern African Customs Union, with South Africa included. The EAC, that's the East African Community, Kenya, Rwanda, Tanzania, seven countries in East Africa. ECOWAS, which is West Africa, 15 countries there. And then a grouping of Central African countries in a grouping called CIMAC.
He says while no goods are being traded under the AFCFTA yet, he expects the first transactions to take place quite soon. He adds that in the interim, they're working on completing the final 10% of tariff offers and rules of origin. The latter are essential in determining which products qualify for tariff exemptions.
I expect that in a month or so, you're going to start to see it happen. And it will start, say, with the Southern African Customs Union, for example, and Egypt, who are very advanced in their preparations. It could start between SACU and the EAC. It could start between SACU and CIMAC. But those countries have to have completed all of the technical prerequisites. Most fundamental are the making the offer, that those offers are technically sound, that they've all ratified the agreement, and that they have domestic legislation in place to administer the agreement, the trade. This is going to happen over a period of time leading up to July. On a parallel track, there would be negotiations to try to get agreement on the rules of origin and the tariffs that take us to the 90% target, which was the original target. We were supposed to have completed last year, but of course was disrupted because of the pandemic. This entire negotiating process was delayed as a result.
Karim believes that step by step, things will eventually harmonize to create the envisioned continent-wide free trade area. The World Bank estimates it could lift tens of millions out of poverty by 2035. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up is the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, tensions between Sudan and Ethiopia over a contested border area rose this week as Sudan accused its neighbor of sending military planes over its airspace. For VOA, Naba Muhaydin reports from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs says Ethiopian military warplanes crossed into Sudanese airspace this week in a dangerous and unjustified escalation of tensions over the disputed Al-Fashaq area. Sudan also says armed Ethiopian gangs backed by the government killed at least 8 civilians in Wad Arud and Aliya villages along the border. The head of the Sudanese military, Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, visited the area and talked to the Sudanese troops guarding the borders. Al-Burhan says Sudan has been patient about this land for so long, for 25 years of offenses and threats and accusations. But everything has a limit. He says Sudan didn't start the conflict, Ethiopia did. And now it's eye for an eye. He says they killed Sudanese women and killed our farmers and burned the lands before. And they claim that it's not Sudanese land and accuse Sudan of entering their lands. Authorities in Sudan's Al-Qadarif state say residents of at least 34 villages near the border have been displaced. Sudan and Ethiopia formed a joint committee in December to resolve the long-standing dispute over Al-Fashaga, located where northwestern Ethiopia meets southeastern Sudan. However, the Ethiopian ambassador in Khartoum has accused the Sudanese military of taking advantage of the war in the Tigray region to seize disputed land. Kelbital Amru called on Sudan's military to withdraw from the border region and stop its military operations.
Very recently, in the first week of November 2020, we witnessed unprecedented military incursion by the Sudan. While the work of the Joint Special Committee was still in progress, and when the Ethiopian National Defense Forces moved to Tigray region on November 4, 2020, for the law enforcement measures, the Sudanese army took the advantage and enters deep inside Ethiopian territory and looted properties, burned camps, detained, attacked, and killed Ethiopians while displacing thousands.
Many Sudanese condemned the ambassador's accusations and called on the military to take wider actions. Security observers think the conflict could have severe ramifications in the region. Military expert Sawar Mikhalid says the recent escalation has very risky security impacts on the residents in the border area and the troops in both sides. Also, the call of the war is threatening large groups of people and tribes, especially in Ethiopia, where these tribes are already witnessing a famine. More than 50,000 Ethiopians recently fled the war in the Tigray region for refugee camps in eastern Sudan. The Sudanese government have moved many of them away from the border, citing the security situation. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Friday marked 2 years since Al-Shabaab terrorists attacked the Dusit G2 Hotel in central Nairobi, killing 22 people. The anniversary comes as Kenya's Mandera, a county bordering Somalia, is seeing increasing attacks from the Islamist militants amid fears they are gaining control of the area. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
It has been 2 years since Al-Shabaab gunmen stormed a Nairobi hotel and office complex and began shooting anyone in sight. Police and troops responded quickly that day, and the death toll was held to 22, much lower than Al-Shabaab's notorious attack on the Westgate Mall in 2013. In more recent months, Al-Shabaab has been active in Mandera, a county 1,000 kilometers from the capital near the Somali border. Speaking Friday at the launch of an education fund, the county's governor, Ali Roba, said he can no longer be silent on the militant group activities in his area.
Where do I keep quiet? Out of 295 schools, primary schools, 129 are literally not open. How do I keep quiet when no private sector investment is happening in Mandera? The only source of employment is the county government because of insecurity. How do I keep quiet when we cannot attract special skilled personnel to come and work for us in the hospitals and other departments from other counties? Because of insecurity.
Last year, the Teachers Service Commission that hires and deploys teachers withdrew them from Mandera County due to insecurity. On Monday, Al-Shabaab militants attacked a bus in Mandera and kidnapped three people, according to government security officials. Roba alleges Al-Shabaab fighters have access to half of its county roads, an allegation denied by Kenyan security officials.
I, as the governor of Mandera County, not any other ordinary person mandated to run the affairs of this county, do categorically and authoritatively state that more than 50% of this county's roads are under the control of Al-Shabaab. Now you can choose to conveniently say it wasn't me, it's not there, and that story is not true. There are isolated cases. Ever since I made that report, we've had four incidences of terror attacks. We are discussing areas that Al-Shabaab have never previously accessed.
Abdullahi Halaka is a security expert in the Horn of Africa. He says Mandera County has many security challenges that need to be addressed.
It's not just Al-Shabaab. We've seen running battles a few months ago. But also we are talking at, we're speaking of a region that generally has historical and security issues. Be it, you know, clan dynamics or even politics from elsewhere spilling into. So I think Mandera then becomes a really, really important problem that needs to be solved.
In late December, clashes between forces of Somalia's federal government and Somalia's Jubaland state spilled over the border into Kenya. Richard Tuta, a security expert based in Nairobi, says the government will need to work with the community to overcome the insecurity.
It takes a network to beat a network. So what is required is to change the approach to engage more of the community. Because remember, this is an asymmetric war. An asymmetric war is that you are fighting people who do not have a physical address, who do not have uniform. People who does not follow the rules of engagement. So the best thing is to engage more of the community leadership and the public itself.
Al-Shabaab has carried out attacks in Kenya for a decade, ever since Kenya sent troops into Somalia to assist the African Union mission mandated to protect Somalia's government and population from the militant threat. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
UN agencies are criticizing Ethiopian authorities for blocking most humanitarian aid from reaching civilians and refugees caught up in the fighting in Ethiopia's northern Tigray province. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
In early December, Ethiopian authorities struck a deal with the United Nations to allow unimpeded humanitarian supplies to reach the many people in need in Tigray. Unfortunately, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says most of that agreement has not been honored. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says the fighting in Tigray continues unabated and civilians continue to be killed and injured. Additionally, he says many people are still not receiving assistance in Tigray more than 2.5 months since the conflict began.
Lack of food, water and health services are affecting hundreds of thousands of people, and our colleagues on the ground are reporting a rise in malnutrition and waterborne diseases. Humanitarian assistance continues to be constrained by the lack of full, safe and unhindered access to Tigray, caused both by insecurity but also bureaucratic obstacles imposed by federal and regional authorities.
Laerke says UN and private agencies have managed to deliver aid in some areas, mainly in the cities. However, he says the number reached is far below the estimated 2.3 million people in need of assistance. The UN Refugee Agency also expresses alarm at its inability to assist tens of thousands of Eritrean refugees under its care in Tigray. Before the conflict began, some 96,000 Eritreans were sheltering in 4 refugee camps. Since then, many have fled the camps in fear of their safety, and others reportedly have been abducted and forcibly returned to Eritrea. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says staff on the ground recently were able to deliver food to some 25,000 Eritrean refugees in the Mai, Aini, and Diharush camps in Tigray. But he says the UNHCR does not have access to the 2 other camps, Shimbela and Hitsats.
Without being on the ground, it's really, really hard to say what has happened, but the disturbing reports and imagery, satellite imagery, in terms of open source satellite imagery, that is really, really troubling. And that's why we repeat our call on the federal authorities to provide humanitarians unhindered access.
The UNHCR calls the situation of Eritrean refugees in Tigray dire and untenable. It says the refugees are extremely vulnerable and unable to provide for their own needs. It warns safe access and swift action are needed to save thousands of lives at risk. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zimbabwe has been receiving much-needed rains that will mean a better harvest for farmers and a more reliable water supply for urban residents. But lingering issues continue to plague the country's supply system. For VOA, Kutai's Venavashi in the Zimbabwean capital Harare speaks with an expert to get the full picture.
Hardlife Mutsingwa is with Community Water Alliance, a local non-profit that has been advocating for safe, clean water. He has been monitoring Zimbabwe's water situation for years and gives insight into this year's prospects.
I want to appreciate the good rains that we have, and the expectation is that it has to contribute to increased dam levels, which ultimately will improve the quantity of raw water available for abstraction within cities. In terms of increased dam levels as a result of the rain, it's a product of a wide range of issues, proper management of catchments.
He adds that following the good rains, he visited Lake Chivero, which is the main water reserve for Harare, but the water levels have not changed much. He says Harare is situated in the catchment area of the lake, which affects the recharge of the lake. Mudzingwa says droughts also play a role in the water supply.
I remember we've had two consecutive years of drought, and it will take some time to reach the levels that we used to have in the past. Other than having good rains and enough raw water, there are other challenges.
Power cuts, once a thing of the past, are slowly coming back.
Electricity blackouts that we are currently experiencing, because availability of water also requires power supply. An example is Mashingo, where the city has gone for almost a month now without water because of challenges on electricity.
He adds that obsolete infrastructure with significant leaks of clean, treated water also remains a hindrance, along with the scarcity of foreign currency to buy water treatment chemicals. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunawashi from Harare.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
I can't do anything. And I wanna put my hands on you. Me, I gotta do anything back to you. But I can't do anything back for you.
Na mapela na
na mapinti wanatuna na maera na kile nataka nikukatika nawe katika tena na kila mahali kume wakati mavera na mapinti wameshachukua meza na kile nataka nikukatika nawe katika tena oh ni same what am I about to do ni kuplay to ni same
Yeah.
I was all alone. Was so bad. And there she go. She touched my heart and said, "Ebezin and those who go."
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a reflection cannot see itself. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.